A very warm welcome to our radio audience from the Midcoast Forum in Maine. My name is Mac DeFord, and I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983 by a small group of retirees living in the Midcoast of Maine with an interest in foreign policy. Our current membership of about 160 includes former diplomats, international businessmen, retired academics, and others with an interest in foreign affairs. For further information, please see our website at www.midcoastforum.org. We have a monthly meeting on a Monday at either the Samoset Resort in Rockport or Point Lookout further up the coast to hear an informed speaker discuss a topic of international interest. Today we're happy to welcome Juan Cole, a professor of history at the University of Michigan. An expert on Islam and the Muslim world, he has lived on and off in various parts of the Muslim world for more than 10 years and travels there frequently. He speaks Arabic, Persian, Urdu, as well as Turkish. He has written widely about Egypt, Iran, and Iraq, as well as the Muslim countries of Southeast Asia, and has commented extensively in articles and on television about Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Iraq War, the politics of Pakistan and Afghanistan, Iranian domestic struggles, and most recently, U.S. and NATO involvement in Libya's civil war. His most recent book, Engaging the Muslim World, came out in 2009. This is his first talk before the Midcoast Forum, but not his first visit to Midcoast, Maine. He spoke at the Camden Conference in the winter of 2005. The conference then was on the Middle East. So we're delighted to welcome Juan back to Midcoast, Maine in the spring. Please give him a warm welcome. He's going to talk about engaging the Muslim world. Juan.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for the warm introduction and for the kind invitation to return at a time when it's not freezing. It's a lovely place, and it's a great pleasure to address you all. My book, Engaging the Muslim World, begins by making a case for why it's important to engage the Muslim world for the United States. And the case that I make is for the general public. I know many of the people in this room know that case as well as I. But let me just hit the highlights before I go on to some more substantive comments. The area stretching from Morocco into the Gobi Desert in northern China contains most of the world's hydrocarbons. The Persian Gulf alone probably has on the order of nearly two-thirds of the world's proven petroleum reserves and a significant proportion, 45% or so, of its natural gas. And with the rise of new extraction and transportation technologies, liquefied natural gas, places like Qatar have become heavy hitters, as unlikely as it might seem for a small desert peninsula with a citizen population of probably 200,000 at the moment, they're negotiating peace among factions in Lebanon. They're flying fighter jets over Libya, and they're simultaneously sitting down at the table in Beijing and Delhi, doing deals. They have a U.S. Air Force base, Al Udeid, but they also have warm relations with the PRC. So this is a unique sort of international formation, this tiny city-state, which is striding the world stage in consequential ways. And of course, through its Qatar Foundation, supports Al Jazeera, the television network, which is a satellite network and is seen throughout the Arab world, and indeed increasingly since it has an English version throughout the world in general. I certainly think that Al Jazeera's television coverage of the protest movements in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Syria, and elsewhere have been extremely important for the spread of this phenomenon, for some of the successes that it has had, and it's no accident that the Egyptian government attempted to remove Al Jazeera from the Nilesat system at the height of the protest movement. It is seen as an extremely subversive organ. The philosophy, I went and interviewed the editors at Al Jazeera, and I asked them, because you know their reputation in the United States is that they're Al Qaeda TV, and I asked them why do they put on Zawahiri or Bin Laden. And they said, well, we don't just put them on. We put on the Israelis, we put on the Americans, we put on everybody. They said, our philosophy is you should cover a story from all sides. And I thought to myself, well, that's probably not the news philosophy of the American news corporations. How often do you see an enemy of the United States interviewed? How often does the point of view of the other side come through? And so Al Jazeera was famous for bringing on the Israelis at a time when most Arabs won't say Israel, they say the Zionist entity. And you had Israeli officials arguing in Al Jazeera. Well, this is, in a way, you know, made possible by Qatar's natural gas windfall. So those hydrocarbons give the region vast potentialities for influence in world affairs. Most of them exercise it rather more quietly than Qatar does behind the scenes, as with the Saudis. But they're not people that one could ignore if one was a world power. They also, of course, pardon my French, have us over a barrel. We use 20, 21 million barrels a day of petroleum in this country. It declined slightly because of the economic downturn, 19, 20. It had been 21 in 2007. We produce 5 million barrels a day of petroleum, 3 million barrels a day of other liquefied hydrocarbons. That's 8. We use 20 or 21. There is a shortfall. And that shortfall has to be made up by imports. And of course, many of our imports are not from the Middle East and the United States, but I think it's about a quarter. Comes from the Middle East of petroleum. But here's some bad news. Our second largest supplier is Mexico. Mexico's fields are not thought to be that deep. Moreover, the Mexicans are increasingly delighting in driving themselves. And so they're beginning to use more and more of their own petroleum rather than exporting it. It is thought that in 3-4 years, we might get no petroleum from Mexico. Now, what a gas hog like the United States really wants as a friend would be the ideal country, would be one that had billions of barrels of petroleum and a population that was either small and couldn't use it themselves or not industrially advanced enough to use a lot of it themselves or for whatever reason used other sources of energy and so forth. So the names of those countries are Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, so on and so forth. And it's not just the United States that needs these resources. Of course, U.S. allies like Japan, deeply dependent. Most of Japan's petroleum comes from the United Arab Emirates. are deeply dependent on Middle Eastern petroleum, as much of Western Europe is. So the U.S. position in the world can't be maintained without the hydrocarbon resources of the Middle East. The U.S. Fifth Fleet is headquartered in Manama in Bahrain. Why is it there? It's because it's providing the security architecture for exports of petroleum and gas from the Persian Gulf. So there have been pundits, Edward Luttwak, the neoconservative is among them, although he's a different kind of neoconservative, who have suggested that, well, the United States has spent way too much time bothering with the Middle East. He actually wrote, I apologize to any of you in the audience who are of Sicilian ancestry, but just write your letters to Edward Luttwak, not to me. He said that the Italians used to bother with Sicily quite a lot, and then they just discovered that there's no point in putting a lot of energy into dealing with backward places, and that the U.S. should follow suit and just ignore the Middle East. I don't think he's been to much of the Middle East because it's not a very backward place anymore. But also, the whole thing that he said was ridiculous from beginning to end. You can't ignore the Middle East. And so the U.S., if it is to be a great power, has to engage with this region. And the region is problematic for the United States for a number of reasons, because the main interest of the U.S. in the Middle East has been to support its ally Israel and to ensure the security of the world's energy supplies. Those commitments have drawn the U.S. into making a number of very bad bargains, and I think also have presented a certain number of temptations for adventurism. So I think we got involved in Iraq in a very unfortunate and, frankly, quite illegal way. And my own view of it is that Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer are not entirely correct, that it was the Israel lobby that impelled the U.S. involvement in Iraq. That was certainly one of the constituents that lobbied for that war. But I think it was also the case that not the big oil companies, because I think ExxonMobil is sitting pretty and they like the world the way it is, but the hungrier mid-level companies, Hunt Petroleum, Halliburton, and their analogs, are running up against a problem, which is that there probably aren't a lot of big new fields to be discovered. And you know, there were several hundred petroleum fields were discovered in the 50s. And then it was less in the 60s and almost none in the 90s. And none to zero in the 20s, and the zeros. So if you were in the oil industry and you were a smaller company, a mid-level company, and you wanted new fields to exploit, where could you get them? Well, there are only two big exploration opportunities where the results are likely to be very substantial and fairly well proven: Iran and Iraq. Why aren't the U.S. companies already in Iran and Iraq, or hadn't been if we're talking in the 90s? Well, the U.S. Congress, in its wisdom, had placed boycotts on U.S. companies dealing with those two countries. Dick Cheney had been Secretary of Defense in the Bush Senior Administration, and in 1995 became CEO of Halliburton. And he spent much of the next 5 years lobbying Congress to take the sanctions off. So it's very bad policy for Congress to deal with international affairs by simply slapping sanctions on countries. It interferes with American corporations who need to do business with them. Cheney spent a substantial amount of political capital, time, and energy lobbying the US Congress in 1997, 1998 to remove sanctions from Iran. Given his later performance as vice president, this comes as something of a shock. How does one explain this about face? And then, of course, when he had been Secretary of Defense, he had argued that it was right not to go on to Baghdad after the expulsion of the Iraqi troops from Kuwait. He said Iraq is not worth very many American lives. He said, if you went into Iraq, I'm paraphrasing, but he said this, and it's a C-SPAN interview, you can see it on YouTube. So if the U.S. went into Iraq in 1991, well, first of all, you would have overthrown the government. Wouldn't you have to stand up a new government? How long would that take? And then wouldn't the Shiites become restive and they're the majority and assert themselves? And wouldn't they hook up with Tehran? Wouldn't the Kurds, who are separatists, make trouble for Turkey, our ally, our NATO ally? A very bad idea, he said, in the early 90s, to go into Iraq. So I see a 180-degree turn here. I see a public figure of long standing who lobbied Congress to remove sanctions from Iran, whose company was doing business behind the scenes with Iraq, who was against an American military intervention of a wide-ranging sort in Iraq. And yet, when Cheney comes to Washington as vice president, his positions are completely the opposite in every way from those that he entertained only a few years before. You know, he was appointed to be the chair of the search committee to find the vice presidential candidate. Reported back that he had unfortunately not identified a viable candidate, and so volunteered for the job himself. So how do I make sense of this about face? I think that he decided that there are other ways to skin the cat. What he wanted was to open up the oil markets of the eastern part of the Middle East, which were closed by congressional sanctions. And why were they closed by congressional sanctions? Well, in part, it was because Iraq and Iran were seen as threats to Israel. And so Congress had wanted to weaken those two countries and interfere with their economic and geopolitical position. So if you couldn't get into Iraq and Iran by having the sanctions removed, there was one other possibility, which is that you could do regime change. And if you were willing to go in that direction, then all of a sudden, the Israel lobby would become your ally. A lot of US corporations would become your allies. And you would have a chance possibly to reshape the Middle East to be a more favorable environment for the United States as a world power, because the eastern part of the Middle East was a very severe policy problem. You had very bad relations with Iran. You had very bad relations with Iraq. In the 1980s, the U.S. used to play Iran and Iraq off against one another, but that was no longer possible in the 90s after the Iran-Iraq war ended. And so Martin Indyk, who is now at Brookings and was the U.S. ambassador for a while to Israel, came up with the idea
what he called dual containment. So the U.S. should just keep pressure on both Iran and Iraq. Oh, this was the Clinton administration policy in the Gulf, but it's a very unsatisfactory policy. So you'd be able to end the policy of dual containment, I think Cheney thought, were you to do regime change in Baghdad and possibly also in Tehran, because I think by then Cheney was thinking large. So
back in the late 90s, Cheney was known as an Arabist, which was not a nice word in Washington. He was Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi long-serving Saudi ambassador, used to have these opulent parties at his mansion out in Northern Virginia, and Cheney was always invited. He was invited to Bandar bin Sultan's daughter's wedding, and then he was on the board of the oversight committee for petroleum in Kazakhstan. He was hobnobbing with Arab leaders. He suddenly comes to Washington in early 2001, and he's surrounded by people who spent their lives fighting the Arab lobby in Washington and who were rather identified with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's very odd. But I think it's because Cheney behind the scenes had decided to do regime change, and he decided to put together a coalition of constituencies in Washington that would support that move. And as I said, I don't have any reason to think that the large oil companies were very interested in all this. They had plenty of fields and bids, but the medium range ones, I think, were very enthusiastic, and Cheney's old buddies at Halliburton and so forth. And what accounts for his willingness now to try to do regime change in the Middle East, I think, is that having been CEO of Halliburton for 5 years, he became aware of how serious the crisis is, because there's a world energy crisis, and it's going to get worse, and it's going to affect the position of the United States. The world produces on the order of 14 terawatts of power, all the gadgets we run taken together. 2050, we probably need 30 terawatts. It's impossible. Can't be had. What sources of easy energy we have now, the hydrocarbons, probably going to go away. In fact, the International Energy Agency estimates that we may have hit peak oil in 2006. So if you look forward, the energy markets in the period of for the 20th century had been buyer's markets. Petroleum was cheap. In fact, the Seven Sisters actually had lobbied Congress to put in price controls on petroleum to stop them from falling lower than water. All of a sudden, with the Arab oil boycott of 1973 and after, partly it was that the world started using more petroleum, partly it was that a cartel effect was put into place. Prices started going up, and then the Seven Sisters, the oil companies, lobbied Congress to take the price controls back off. So you have this secular trend towards higher prices, towards more competition, and I think by about 1996 or 97, when Cheney was the head of Halliburton, it became clear that petroleum was becoming a seller's market. And in a seller's market, it's more like a game of musical chairs. Somebody could end up without a chair if petroleum countries let long-term bids that are proprietary in order to get a price benefit that would lock other consumers out of the market. So what if China did a lot of deals with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia didn't have enough petroleum to send to the United States anymore. Looking forward, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen. So it becomes absolutely necessary, if the U.S. is to remain a superpower from this point of view, that new petroleum fields be opened up. And the only big ones that are known about, Iraq is thought to have 115 billion barrels of petroleum under the ground, were under congressional sanctions. So I think that the Iraq war was a way of getting around congressional sanctions and opening up the oil fields. It wasn't that, you know, the kind of fringe left said this was a war for oil and we were going to just steal Iraq's oil. No, it wasn't that they wanted to just occupy the oil fields. It was that they wanted Iraq's political formation to change, bring it back into the world community, get rid of sanctions and boycotts, and then let them let bids so that the oil companies could exploit the petroleum. And Cheney is probably right about that. I think the whole thing is much more difficult and will take a lot more time than he had envisaged. But the effect that he wanted to produce probably will be produced, which is that Iraq's production will come back online and that it will grow. Iraq was doing 2.8 million barrels a day under the Oil for Food program of the UN. It's back up to about that now, and they're hoping to do 12 million barrels a day over the next 7 years. That may be optimistic, but eventually Iraqi petroleum will come online. But the frame within which I perceive Cheney to have been functioning was itself incorrect, which is that I think Cheney thought that that would solve the problem. And of course, Rupert Murdoch famously said that we'd have $14 a barrel petroleum. I don't think he does a very good job of delivering news. And he's also not very good at analyzing energy markets. Why don't we have $14 a barrel of petroleum? Why do we have 100 and, I think it hit 108 barrel of petroleum? Because demand has increased. China is now the world's second largest consumer. Indians are starting to drive cars. This is very bad news for the rest of us. It was much better that they should be on bicycles. They're now going to produce carbon, and they're going to use petroleum, and they're going to compete with us for it. And Tata, the great Indian industrial company, is making a $2,000 car, which is affordable for Indians. I couldn't tell you how depressed I was when I heard that. So demand is growing so rapidly that even if Iraq came online, and even if Iraq produced as much petroleum as Saudi Arabia, it's still not going to produce $14 a barrel petroleum, and it also is not going to solve the world energy crisis, which is going to continue to be a factor. There isn't enough petroleum in the world that we know about to actually meet the needs that we're going to see over the next 40 years. And you can't be a superpower unless you have inexpensive energy. You certainly can't be a superpower if you have really, really bad relations with the people who have the inexpensive energy. Now, I'm very green. I'm all for moving to alternatives. I think the potential is there over the next 50 or 60 years to replace most hydrocarbons with alternatives. But let's face it, that's not an immediate prospect. There's going to be a hump we have to get over the next 30, 40 years. Better batteries have to be invented. Better photovoltaic cells have to be invented. Intermittency has to be resolved by storage because, you know, sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time and so forth. So in the long term, there is a solution to the energy crisis, which is solar. In the short term, that's not a solution at all because it's 3-4 times as expensive as hydrocarbons. And in the medium term, you're going to need hydrocarbons. There's no way around it. And if you need hydrocarbons, the United States needs the Middle East. And it's not just a matter of energy markets. The Middle East is important for other reasons as well. In the world we're entering, a lot of countries are going to experience shrinking populations if present demographic trends continue. Germany's population is about 82 million. We think it'll end up at 60. Russia already went from 150 to 140. The Japanese are expected to go from 130 million to 110. This is a huge, vast social experiment, which is unprecedented as a matter of natural birth rate and death rate causes. That is to say, there have been instances where populations have fallen dramatically, but it was like the Black Death that caused, you know, we think Europe lost a third of its population during the Black Plague. But to have these kinds of falls in population is just because people are not having children is remarkable. And on the other hand, there's going to be a need for labor. There's going to be a need for workers who pay into Social Security so that the Germans can retire. I think the Japanese work so hard on those robots because they hope that they won't have to import the labor. And I think that hope is forlorn. Japan is, as you know, a fairly closed society and very nervous about immigration, but I think they're probably going to have to bite the bullet and just allow a lot of Koreans and Chinese into their country as workers. They do behind the scenes a bit. So the high natal areas of the world, Muslims. Where is the labor force going to come from for the mid-21st century? That part of the world. Egypt adds 1 million people every 8 months. The parts of the former Soviet Union that have high birth rates, the Muslim parts. It's a little bit mysterious as to why this should be so. I don't think it has anything to do with Islam, but it certainly is the case. We are already seeing the kind of problems that this has caused to have large numbers of Muslim guest workers in Europe, although the problems are not as severe as I think some people make them out to be. I'm always amused when European nativists, you know, the European far right, they say, Muslims have come into our country, and they are starting to influence our politics and even want to shape our laws. And I said, well, you know, turnabout is fair play. What do you think the Europeans have been doing to the rest of the world for the last 400 years? The Europeans are now getting a taste of their own medicine. So, again, the Muslim world is indispensable because it's going to be the labor force of the next century. And I would say that the U.S. has not been doing very well with its dealings with the Muslim world. And in many ways, its policies have been a little bit difficult for me to understand, although I specialize in the region. If you look out over the Middle East and you think, well, where, let's just say you weren't a pacifist and you thought it might be good to have a major Muslim country under U.S. military occupation, what country would you choose? And in what universe would it be Afghanistan? What vital American interests are there? I really can't understand it. And I think I understand how it happened. I think the U.S. was drawn into Afghanistan by 9/11, by the fact that it had been more or less a failed state, that Al-Qaeda had set up shop there and so forth. But I think after that, there's kind of a mission creep. You stand up the Karzai government through the bond process, then the Karzai government is weak, ineffectual, indecisive, and it's so corrupt that it actually charters airplanes to carry the cash to Dubai. Billions of dollars of cash flying out of Kabul to Dubai. Since Dubai, investing in Dubai real estate is sort of like giving your money to Countrywide or Bear Stearns. Not only are they corrupt and stealing the country blind, but they're also stupid and have lost a lot of that money. You know, the Dubai made the Dubai World, which was a set of islands off the coast, which were shaped to be in the form of countries or islands. So you could own France if you bought a set of these islands, and from an airplane above, it looks like France, or you could own the Bahamas or whatever it might be. And then they were building these opulent chalets and things there. Well, the Dubai real estate market was a bubble, and the whole thing went bust, and Dubai was $40 billion in hock to European banks, and nobody can afford to keep. There was a lot of upkeep in those islands because they were artificial and a landfill, and you had to keep putting sand on them and things. So now they're just kind of sinking into the Persian Gulf, and they look ugly, they're eyesore, and they're dowdy. And that's where a lot of Karzai's cronies put their money. So I think we're in a position now where the Karzai government is unstable. The Taliban probably could overthrow it, and therefore we have to be in between Karzai and the Taliban. But it's a losing game because the Pashtuns aren't naturally Taliban. The Pashtuns, a lot of them don't like Taliban, but if given a choice between Western Christian Marines and their cousins, over time, my guess is they choose the cousins. I mean, you'd really, really have to like the Marines a lot to choose them. And of course, the Marines are going into their villages and conducting search and destroy missions and invading the privacy of their homes and killing their cousins occasionally from the air and so forth, so that over time, you're likely to have a certain number of feuds between the Pashtun tribes and the Marines. So I just don't see how that ends well, and I don't understand why the U.S. thinks that it's such a major priority, because we're putting a lot of resources into Afghanistan. And the Iraq thing, of course, was illegal, and it turned into a civil war, and it all ended very badly, and Cheney still hasn't gotten his cheap petroleum out of it. So in a way, I think we've put our energies in all the wrong places. And while we were doing that, all of a sudden, the places that we thought were nailed down and were, you know, allies and they had strong military governments and we didn't have to worry about them, like Egypt, poof. So now, instead of having an aircraft carrier, we have a very leaky and tattered raft in the Middle East. So my point to you is that A, it's indispensable, the region, and B, our policies have put us in a very unfavorable position to deal with it. Thank you very much.
Okay, here is one that gets into the heart of some of the problems in the Middle East. What debate or debates do you think are taking place now in Israel over its future policy towards the Palestinians? Any prospects of change?
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to be a keynote speaker at a conference in Israel in late May, so I'll know the answer to that question better in a couple of weeks. But let's make a distinction between the Israelis and the Israeli government. Because you have a very peculiar government in power right now. The Israeli government is all the people that, if you went back to the mid-1980s, you would be convinced should be in jail and would never, ever be allowed to run the country. So it's a little bit bizarre that you have someone like Avigdor Lieberman as foreign minister. Lieberman began life as a club bouncer in Moldavia and went on to become an extremely corrupt businessman with secret offices in Cyprus, which Mossad is trying to get a hold of. He is a kind of Milosevic kind of nationalist. I mean, he's transferred that Milosevic kind of thinking from Eastern Europe into Israel. And so wants to strip the citizenship from the million Israelis who are of Arab heritage. Of course, is extremely hawkish, wants to attack Lebanon and so forth and so on. And were these policies actually to be implemented, they would be extremely dangerous for Israeli security. So Lieberman and his Yisrael Beitenu, or Israel Our Home Party, has positioned Bibi Netanyahu and the Likud Party as the moderate mainstream. And the Likud Party has its origins, frankly, in 1930s European fascist thinking. They have this idea of the iron wall. You build an iron wall around Israel. If anybody bothers you, you hit them hard. You make them abject. No compromise on territory. Never give back an inch of the West Bank or Gaza. So the Likud Party, which stands for those things, is now the voice of sweet reason, and Lieberman is playing the wild man. So this government is not reflective of the Israelis in general. You ask Israelis, would you trade land for peace? 66% say yes. They have been saying yes for decades. So, but their government wouldn't trade an inch of land for peace. Moreover, the government is a coalition. It has Shas, the ultra-Orthodox party in it, and so forth, and the government would fall if any of the major partners withdrew. And all of the major partners are very committed to settling the West Bank, colonizing it as much as possible, and also blockading Gaza and keeping it as a kind of big penitentiary where people are kept on the edge of starvation. Well, it's a very bad situation. And it's an unrealistic situation because it certainly can't go on for decades. But the U.S. runs interference for this situation. The Obama vetoed a condemnation of Israel's expansion of settlements in the West Bank very recently at the UN. And I don't find that most Israelis are able to face reality. They don't seem to be capable of thinking about the future. They're kind of under siege in a bunker, surrounded by enemies, and now it's unclear who is the enemy and who is the friend. Things are all in turmoil about them. And I don't hear Israelis making sense of the future. The former head of Mossad and the former head of Shin Bet, the domestic intelligence agency, and a number of other prominent Israeli intellectuals just released a peace plan which says go back to 67 borders. Which, I mean, anybody in their right mind knows that that's the way you settle this thing. But the likelihood of that having any political purchase is very low. So I'm very pessimistic. I think that the situation is we're in for a long-term quagmire in the Levant, and I don't think that the demographic or political equation is such that down the road, 20, 30, 40 years, things look good for Israel. And you could have, at some point, substantial out-migration. Israelis are well-educated, and they're well-off, and they could live elsewhere.
Okay, moving next door, what do you see under the current situation with what's going on there? What are the prospects for the current government of Syria?
Well, the current government of Syria is now having to shoot people in order to stay in power. Not that it has ever scrupled to do so, in the past. But in Banias, this northwestern city today, it was revealed that they had brought in troops behind the scenes and started just sniping at people and shooting them down, the protesters. They've used main force in Deraa, the southern city near Jordan, and elsewhere. So the protest movement in Syria has spread. It began in Deraa. It was joined by a few other places, the northern port of Latakia, and in the Kurdish areas. There are about 2 million Kurds in Syria, since Syria is predicated on the Ba'ath Party ideology of being an Arab state, and Kurds are not Arabs. They fit uneasily into that system. And the Syrians actually, in the 1960s, stripped thousands of them of their citizenship in Syria. So they're stateless Kurds in Syria. And so they were rioting. And the regime has tried to offer some changes to mollify its critics. So Bashar al-Assad went to the Kurdish areas and, by a stroke of the pen, restored citizenship to about 100,000 Kurds. I think there are still lots of hundreds of thousands to go. But in that very area where he did that, the next day, 3,000 people were in the streets demonstrating. So being a citizen is nice, being able to get a passport, you know, being able to register with the state, those are all good things. But, like, you might want more in life. You might want a say in your government that you're now a citizen of. And the Ba'ath Party is a one-party state. So far, whether a government stays in power or not has partially depended upon the attitude of the armed forces to the protests. In Tunisia and Egypt, the armed forces called the president in and said, "We are not going to shoot our people for you." And when the military tells you that and you're a dictator, you might as well just get on the helicopter right there. The Syrian military is unlikely to do that. If they're ordered to shoot, they'll shoot. Partly it's because Syria has this odd sectarian government. So the Alawi minority is about 10% of the population, but it populates a lot of the high offices and the officer corps and so forth. And if there's a revolution, the Alawis certainly are going to be losers. So I think the Alawi officer corps will support the Alawi president. And so things could get very bloody and unstable. I don't make predictions, but I would say that what you want to look for is a split in the officer corps. If you start seeing officers going over to the protesters, then that would be a sign that this government is maybe doomed.
Okay, we've got one more specific question, and that is about Libya. And the guy who's asking, the guy or woman who's asking this question says, "I know that you were in favor of our going into Libya. How do you think it's all going to end?"
Well, I should qualify and say that I was in favor of the United Nations resolution establishing a no-fly zone and an order to protect civilians. I would be very distressed if we went in more than that implied. But I think that once there's international intervention in a place like Libya, you can expect the problems that ensue to go on a long time. I mean, from the time that NATO started bombing the nationalist Serbs till the time of the Dayton Accords was over a year. And from the time that started until Milosevic was captured by his own people and turned over to The Hague was from 1994 to 2001. So I don't think that this thing will be over with tomorrow. I think people have a lot of unrealistic expectations. What we found in Bosnia was that the enemy is very good at camouflage. It makes it difficult to bomb them if you can't see them or you can't tell which side they're on. And that kind of thing is already happening in Libya. But I don't expect it to go on as long as the problems in the Balkans did. And partly it's because Gaddafi's support base is thin. It seems clear to me that before he started rolling tanks and firing artillery shells at civilian crowds in the center of his cities, that something like 90% of the population had thrown off his rule. So over time, you know, NATO's destroying tanks every day. I think he just won't have the wherewithal to impose himself, and I think a lot of cities will again throw off his rule. I don't think, you know, a lot of commentators are saying, well, the rebels will organize in the east and march west and liberate Tripoli. I don't actually think that's very likely. Apparently, the Libyans were disarmed by the Gaddafi regime, so they don't have weapons, and they don't know how to use them, unlike the Iraqis. I guess, you know, Iraq had 80 weapons depots, and all Iraqis had guns and knew how to use them. So if you were going to militarily occupy a country in the Middle East, it shouldn't have been Iraq. Whereas the doctors say that the biggest source of injuries that they're seeing in the hospitals from the fighting in Libya is self-inflicted wounds. So I don't expect the rebels to march west from the east, but I do think that sooner or later there won't be enough tanks to hold down Zawiya and Zuara and Zintan and the cities of the west and Tajura and other places around and in Tripoli where there are working class neighborhoods that don't like Gaddafi. And I think that sooner or later, even the Tripoli elite will get out the chloroform and put the Gaddafis on a transport plane to Caracas.
Lucky guy. All right, this one is another country-specific question. How do you think Turkey's government will evolve as the Arab Spring, that's in quotation marks, evolves? Where's Turkey heading, the Islamist right. government?
Well, I was talking a little bit about this yesterday, but I see Turkey's foreign policy as very much about trade. The breakthrough that the Justice and Development Party, the Muslim-tinged party, they're not really an Islamist party, it's not advocating Islamic law and so forth, it's advocating a kind of Turkish multiculturalism in which there would be a place for believing Muslims. But the policy of the Justice and Development Party has been what the foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, calls harmonious relations with neighbors. Turkey had had very bad relations with Syria, it had very bad relations with Iraq, it had bad relations with Iran, and so on and so forth. And Davutoğlu has gone around repairing all those relations. And as they've been repaired, opportunities have emerged for bilateral trade with those countries. And Turkey went from having, I think it was 12% of its trade with the Middle East in 2000 to having it be about a quarter now. This is an addition of billions of dollars in trade. And they're trying to make a free trade zone with Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, which would be worth $3 billion a year. And they do a 2.5 with Israel and so forth. They've also expanded trade enormously with Europe because when they were put in the queue for European Union membership, a lot of tariff barriers were dropped for them. And so while it's a little unlikely they'll ever get to be in the EU, in the meantime, they have access to the German economy, which they've made big use of. They do $10 billion a year with Germany. So the Arab Spring doesn't change a lot for Turkey, in my view. The policies that Turkey has been pursuing would be relatively unaffected by the advent of parliamentary democracy in Syria. In fact, it might be helped. So, for instance, Egypt had not been a country where Turkey had big diplomatic or trade breakthroughs. You know, it still has that old military rule and more or less socialist policies, and it's privatized a little bit. But if Egypt opens up, it could be a real playground for Turkish businessmen, and real opportunities for bilateral economic and diplomatic relations might emerge that weren't there under Mubarak. So I'm, as you can tell, bullish on Turkey. I think as long as Davutoğlu is in charge of foreign policy, that he's doing very interesting things in the region, which are on the whole positive and redound not only to, I think, a better security relations, but also to an increase in trade and economic efflorescence in the region.
Unfortunately, we've only got time for one more question. I'm sorry. This is, will emancipation, maybe it should be would or will emancipation of women in the Middle East change the whole dynamic of politics there?
You're a pessimist. You changed it to would. Well, I mean, the first thing to ask is what would emancipation of women look like? I think it's important to underline that we're talking about patriarchal societies in which patriarchy is embedded in law, and in some ways, the legal position of women has gotten worse in the last 30 years in a lot of countries. Iran is an example, even in Egypt. Just to give you an example, in 1929, there was an Egyptian constitution that provided that if women were to travel abroad and to get a passport, they would need their husband's permission. Well, Jahan Sadat got rid of that one in the 1970s, and if any of you have ever seen Jahan Sadat on television, you can't imagine her asking permission to do anything. However, in 1978, Anwar Sadat began allowing parliamentary elections, not real parliamentary elections, but the form of parliamentary elections, sort of like Chicago. And so the ruling party always won, but a few dissidents or members of other parties were allowed to be in parliament from time to time, and the police counted the ballots, so it was all very exact. But they let some of the Muslim Brothers into parliament, and they immediately sponsored a bill to go back to the provisions of the 1929 Constitution. So then women were put back under the situation of having to get permission from their husbands to travel abroad. So that sort of thing has been going on. Ironically, at the same time, however, if you look at social statistics, the position of women has changed dramatically for the positive. Health statistics are better. Literacy rates are way up. Under the Shah, female literacy was like maybe 30%. Today, it's over 70. You have this enormous new generation of young women who are literate, and they blog. They blog anonymously. They talk about very racy things. In Egypt as well, you could see the women in the streets protesting and so forth. At one point, this man came up and said, "You should be at home." And I don't think they went home. Literacy has much increased education. A majority of the undergraduates in Iranian universities are women. And I believe this is also true in Saudi Arabia. So there are many contradictions here. And then because of the Iran-Iraq war and the loss of so many young men's lives, women moved into the workforce in Iraq and in Iran. That maybe is not such a great thing if you're a widow and have kids, but their participation in the public sphere is enormously greater than it used to be. And you know, in Egypt, women have started wearing headscarves. They don't veil very much, but they put on headscarves. They call it hijab. And when I was there in the last time for a long period of time in the 80s, I don't think more than 5% of women covered their heads in Egypt. But I was back last May, and now 5% are uncovered. Almost everybody wears a headscarf in public. But I was reading this one anthropologist who was arguing it's because the women have come into the public sphere. They're secretaries, they've got jobs, they come out shopping. And so this is a declaration that although they're in the public sphere, they're not sluts, and that they're allowed to be in the public sphere because they're pious Muslim Arab women. So I think that if you attend to the social statistics, that those are the more important things than some of the legal restrictions, because those are, after all, legislation that can be changed. You can't snap your fingers and have 50% of your women suddenly know how to read and write. And I suspect that the emancipation of women on the educational sphere with regard to work opportunities, and so forth, will ultimately produce some legislative change as well in the region.
One, too. Thank you very much.